your talk. It was very informative, very interesting. Okay, my feeling that I got from your talk was, it felt like a bit of defeatism, if I would use the word. I mean, it's not like I'm personally very hopeful about this the situation right now, but I still think there are some contradictions in this whole process that are still open-ended, are still to be seen how they will unfold in the very near future, actually. And I'm basically talking about, which is the point that I would like us to get back, for you to get back a little bit and discuss, about the possibility of a Grexit. Because the main contradiction, it seems to me, is that, okay, Syriza has made a whole bunch of concessions already, but they still seem to have like this, what they call like a red line, you know, that they would not, they're not willing to cross. I mean, recently they just said that they will not be able to pay the next to the IMF and so on. So to me it seems that they have to make this decision. If the Eurozone is not flexible at all, then they will have to maybe default pretty soon. And that would imply a Grexit. And they're not discussing very much that within Syriza. I mean, I've seen that some sectors of Syriza are for this idea, but also because they do not have, for the moment, the popular support for a Grexit. Nobody would like to leave the Eurozone in Greece right now. So they are not talking about it openly as a strategy. But this is the main contradiction, because what other option is left? Either they leave the Eurozone, or they completely give in to the Eurozone demands and go back to the zero. As you know, the same as PASOK did, go back to the memorandum. So it's as if the election never happened. And then is the real, like, that is the real tension, in my opinion, the way I see it now, that needs to be addressed some point in the future, in the near future. Like a contradiction that will need to be addressed. It's unavoidable. So, yeah, a little bit more optimistically, I would say that we have still some room of maneuver, you know, considering the option of a Grexit and working it out with the population and reinforcing the democratic process to have this, because, you know, people support, the polls have shown that they're very supportive of Syriza, but what would happen then if they would come up with a strategy, okay, now there's no solution within the Eurozone, so we have to leave, and start discussing it out in the public. So that is the question. What would happen? Is that possible? I mean, the way I see it, there's still this tension that needs to be resolved in the very near future.
Well, let me say it this way. Even in considering this contradiction, which I will get into more in detail, I would say even that contradiction and any possible resolution of that contradiction is still not very optimistic. What I mean is that even if there was a Grexit, that means a very radical further devaluation of people's lives, at least in the beginning. I mean, the exact the consequences of a Grexit are not clear to anyone, but there are certain things, there are certain factors that you have to take in mind. And one very important one would be, just to briefly explain, is that Greece is very much based on imports. If you have a devaluation, like a change of currency, imports would become extremely expensive. So a number of things that Greece imports would no longer be available. And we're not just talking about iPhones and stuff, we're talking about gas, medical equipment, you know, all these things would become very difficult to get. People's, like, wages, property, anything would be devalued by at least 50 to 60%, and that would be like, compared to the last 5 years of like very drastic, you know, devaluations, that would be a step even further. Okay, so even if that choice is taken, which I don't think it will, but I'll explain why, it doesn't sound very promising. It would might in the future create a better condition for like poorer people in Greece if a specific policy is followed, because a change of currency in itself does not determine policy. The question is what you do once you have a different currency, and that's like also like up for grabs. I mean, I don't think Syriza has a very even closely like socialist program in any way. They will be forced to do a number of things like give out wages, create jobs, because otherwise people would starve to death. And we can imagine a situation similar to Argentina, where there was some kind of growth after the default for the first 10 years. But there are very, if we compare, for example, these two countries, there are very huge differences. Argentina could rely on exports. They became like the first exporter of soya in the whole world. And they had like certain key economic sectors to rely on in order to provide this kind of growth that Greece doesn't have. But even so, I would, going back to the whether this contradiction, as I said, the Grexit was the only thing that Syriza could have used. They did not use it, and they will not use it. Now, in a way, it's too late. If Syriza had in mind to actually use that as a threat or as a reality in terms of like, okay, if Europe doesn't accept what we do, we're just going to leave the Eurozone and do it on our own, they would have had to have some kind of preparation for that. What they have done instead is create a situation where they also talk about the Grexit as a complete catastrophe. So what they've convinced even more people in Greece that, you know, leaving the Eurozone is going to be worse. So even if now there's a talk about a referendum in relation to the new measures or the new memorandum, a government only does a referendum when they know what the answer is. You know, they don't do it otherwise. They know what the answer is going to be. And the way Syriza is portraying the dilemma now in the referendum is either we accept a kind of honorable, you know, concession and accept some kind of like continuation of the agreement as they present the new situation, or chaos. And this is basically more or less how they're portraying it. There's a small part of Syriza, the kind of left wing of Syriza, which is supposed to be in favor of like this, but they're, to be honest, they're quite dishonest, because either they do not know or have no understanding of what Grexit would mean, or the ones who do know, like Lapavitsis, for example, they don't really explain it, because they know it would not be popular to anyone. Lapavitsis has been saying that, you know, the best solution for Greece is to leave the euro for the last 5 years, and for the equal amount of time he's been saying that I have a plan of reconstructing the economy and making this a successful thing. Nobody has ever seen this plan in the last 5 years, okay? And the reason is simple, because if you take the numbers down, it doesn't really add up. It would only work if you accept that the Greek economy from now on would be something like Romania, Bulgaria, or something even worse. If you, and that would be the realistic understanding of the Grexit. If you try to sell that to people, it's not going to work. And not only because like a lot of people would be resistant to losing their money and their like whatever property they have. It is also contrary to the very widespread feeling in Greece of being part of Europe as a kind of imaginary constitution of an identity as well. The idea that you are equal with Europe, the idea that your kids could, you know, study somewhere abroad, the idea that you can take a trip, you know, to another European country. All these things constitute like a very important, you know, imaginary understanding of Greeks themselves, which they are not willing to lose. And that's what would happen if Greece exited the country. And people who call for a Grexit either do not understand this reality or they wish to hide it. You know, Lapavitsa's idea of the restructuring of the economy is very, very often close to something like North Korea, honestly. Like the way he imagines it, it's like, you know, it has this like grandiose idea of like reindustrialization of the Greek economy and focusing like, into sectors that can, you know, Greece can have a certain like autarky in relation to the markets, and it's just like nonsense, you know.
But what about some basic Keynesian policies? They're not even so radical, but people like Stiglitz would advocate for, like, you know, okay, as soon as you leave the euro, you can have some capital control, you can peg the currency, the exchange, and so on and so forth. I mean, not to have these devastating consequences in relation to the Greek economy in the context of a global economy.
Yeah. I mean, even if...
And nationalizing the banks also.
Yeah, well, I'll start with that. Banks are, in a sense, they are nationalized because the Greek government is paying for them to remain afloat. That they get money to give to the banks, you know. So in a certain sense, they are already nationalized. I don't know what a further nationalization would mean or where they would get the money. But even so, let's say that Greece leaves the euro and does not, you know, face a kind of like economic war from the rest of Europe. Let's say it happens in a kind of understandable way. Capital controls are not very easy to do. It would be more likely that you would have a double currency in Greece, because you have like you have a very kind of advanced tourist sector, where it would be impossible to force like tourists to pay in drachmas rather than euros. And the tourist sector would be like would actually be one of the sectors that would do well in case Greece leaves the euro, because it would become very competitive and cheap. But it would be, it's almost certain that people would pay in euros, and there would be like a double currency circulating in Greece. People would like hide the euros, and then they would use drachmas in order to do their everyday exchanges. But when you have like two currencies in a country, and one is stronger, and is like not as unstable as the drachma would be for at least a year, then the euro will basically win over the drachma. So you cannot really have a proper monetary policy when you have a double currency and one you do not control. And like one of the reasons you couldn't control it is like the internet. There's a very clear example. It's not like it used to be in the past. Now you can book things on the internet and pay directly in an account that someone has in Germany. You know, so you would have like people, you know, who rent flats saying, okay, it's like 20 euros a day if you come here, like in the equivalent of drachmas, or 10 euros if you pay in my German account. And that's, you know, how it would work. Nobody would actually want to pay more. So there's no way to actually, capital controls to actually impose them in an effective way. And there's no way to actually control the currency exchange either. It would have to be devalued like quite a lot in the first year in order to reach a level, you know, and kind of counteract inflation and all these issues. So it's not that simple. Considering as well that there might be a kind of like you know, economic war from Europe if it's done in a kind of like rupture, like we don't give a fuck about you anymore, we're not going to pay your debts, so we're like doing our own currency. If it happens like that, I can imagine that there will be quite a fierce economic war from Europe, the same as you had like in Argentina in the end with the hedge funds that refused to accept the kind of restructuring. And yeah, it doesn't look very promising, even in that scenario. But I would say it's not really a possibility. Like, the Eurozone doesn't want Greece to leave the euro, because that would have consequences that they cannot even imagine. The government doesn't want, Syriza doesn't want Greece to leave the euro, and apparently almost like 80% of the population don't want to leave. So I can't even imagine how Greece would leave if all those people involved are against it, you know. Maybe like an accident, but like that's still very hard to imagine.
So probably they would just give in to all the...
They don't have a choice really anymore. Yeah, they don't really have a choice. It's like...
I mean, what do you think about, like, if there's propaganda or some kind of repression against alternatives, or when it comes to other countries, if other countries in more or less similar situations would leave at the same time, or just been, if you think that there's been any dialogue between, like, Syriza and Podemos, and this, I mean, if that's some kind of threat, and then there's, like, do you think there's been like some kind of propaganda or some kind of repression against, I mean, not outspoken, but,
yeah,
you know, under the surface to keep it down, if there would be some, like, any idea of these countries working together. I mean, I know that they're for like a small, like just a flash in history and time. There was like some discussions coming up about like Mediterranean countries working together. If you have any comments.
Podemos is like an interesting example. Podemos, as soon as Syriza was elected and started in negotiation, they made it clear that they distanced themselves from Syriza. They said that we're not. And for them, that was actually quite smart. Because what Podemos said is that what is being done to Greece at the moment from the rest of the Eurozone could not be tolerated in Spain. And they have a point, because Spain is like the fourth biggest economy in the Eurozone, and it's not a kind of an actual threat that Spain like might leave, is much more effective, and Spain would do probably much better, much sooner outside the Eurozone than Greece. So the kind of like a mechanism that was being used against Greece in order to stop Syriza would not work in other countries. Now, if other countries, like, I don't think there is an actual negotiation at that level. I don't really know, but I don't think there is one. But there is always a possibility of like other countries leaving, and it's becoming like stronger and stronger. Not so much as a result of like a change of government, but in relation to the actual unfolding of the crisis. Like for some countries, and I'm thinking Italy is a good example, they would be much better outside the Eurozone the day after, you know. So for them, it's becoming increasingly difficult, in a way, to justify their, you know, continuing existence within the Eurozone to the extent that they're not really gaining that much from it. Instead, they have the policies imposed that are working against their interest to a certain extent. So far, the policies are like they keep a kind of balance. I mean, I don't know what would happen in the future. I don't think anyone knows. And it could be something as sudden, or it could be something more gradual that we see coming. But at the moment, I don't see anything like that happening. But it could happen in the future. And that would really, yeah, that would change the whole outlook of the situation in relation to everything, even Syriza and everything. But I would say it's still kind of speculative. And to the extent that they're still trying to make policies within the European Union to keep those countries within, and I think the quantitative easing mechanism of the ECB has exactly that role, to give the impression to countries that are not benefiting right now that you can actually get something out of it, because we're starting a process, we're printing money, and it's like free for you, you know. And I think the main reason behind this idea of quantitative easing was to help like France or Italy and those countries that are not doing that well but are still kind of very stable process within Europe, not to start really considering like exits. We will know the results of this QE like later on. So far it's just started like a couple of months ago and nobody really knows. There's like contradicting reports. But I think we still have some time in order to see, you know, if that would make the situation more stable or less.
Yeah, I'm interested in this period you mentioned between 2010 and 2012, with this massive industrial action, and that Syriza is the result of the failure of that movement. Is there any discussions in Greece now as to why it failed? What?
The movement?
Yeah. Is there an analysis?
Well, there are many different approaches. a large part of the, let's say, the radical scene would choose an option between, like, heavy repression. You know, there's always this emphasis on the repressive side of the state, or the fact that the majority of the Greek population, petit bourgeois kind of people, were unwilling to, you know, radicalize their struggles. That would be like one form that people would use to explain it. To be honest, I haven't come across a lot of material dealing with that issue. I don't think, I have the impression, well, I might be wrong, I have the impression that people are not really happy to admit that it's over. You know, my kind of approach is based on this idea that it's more or less over. I think a lot of people in Greece are still have a hope that it is not over, or it's just like a temporary setback or something else. So I don't feel they feel the same need to try and explain what went so wrong, to the extent that they don't necessarily agree with the fact that it's a different situation now, that it's over. That's the best I can think of in terms of, because I haven't really seen like a lot of people trying to explain exactly what went wrong. I think it's because they don't feel it's like necessary at the moment.
It sounds like that. The same reason. Syriza is the answer to the wrong question. So this is, failure leads to not failure.
Yeah.
But there's no critical analysis of why did we got this massive not enough radicalization.
I mean, you have to.
The whole answer, you think?
Well, when we say a critical analysis, that would mean coming from the radical part of the scene in Greece. And you have to keep in mind, for them, I would say the majority of them voted for Syriza in recognition of this like defeat, but also as a kind of, you know, it was a very strong feeling to get rid of the previous government, and it's like openly extreme right-wing kind of policies and kind of alliance with the neo-Nazis. There was a kind of feeling like that at that level that forced a lot of people to say, we want to get rid of this, regardless of what the actual program is. So now people are still a bit kind of lost, because they're like, they voted for something, they see it's not going to work at all, and that I think they're caught between giving it some more time or hoping for something to come better, or just openly making war, like parts of the anarchists are doing today, unsuccessfully, I would say, to Syriza, because I don't think they're approaching it in a very reasonable way. But that's kind of the split. I mean, in that split, I don't see a lot of people taking a step back and trying to understand what has happened, like in the whole context. I think it's more like, you know, the Greek anarchist radical scene is very used on dealing with like everyday, you know, what is at stake at the moment, and not so much a kind of critical reflection and elaboration of what's happened in the past.
Okay, cool.
Saying a lot.
I have a question to your question, just to be sure that I understand correctly. Your question was, why did the movement fail? In which movement are you referring to? Like in general, the anti-austerity and anti-memorandum and...
No, I was mainly focusing on this massive industrial action. You were mentioned, what was it, 24, 27 general...
23.
General strikes during this period, and it had no effect at all. And this this strategy and this mode of acting is still, even though we can see the total collapse of this strategy from outside, this is still the same strategy that the entire European left, radical left, advocate as an answer, you know? Even though we can see that, oh my God, they failed miserably, you know. So So that was, I was quoting with this, if there's a critical analysis, we might learn something. You know, what's wrong with our picture here? Because we can't advocate something that's useless, and obviously that was useless in this case.
I can tell you what I think about this. It wasn't useless. It's not so much that it was useless. I wouldn't say it like that. I mean, the weapons you use to fight against something are the ones that are available. You cannot like create something out of nowhere. So your actual position within an economic cycle is what determines how you can stop this cycle. So the very simple, you know, notion of a strike means stopping economic activity as a form of like putting pressure. It wasn't useless. It was unsuccessful, I would say, because they were entirely determined to go through with those measures at whatever cost. So the same tactics anywhere else, I think, in Europe would have completely different results. You couldn't have like the same let's put it this way. One of the reasons that Greece has managed to sustain itself to a certain extent is that because, in contrast to other countries where you have a welfare mechanism, in Greece you never really had one. What you have to fall back to is the family relations. And this is what still keeps a lot of people afloat. Welfare didn't really exist in Greece in terms of like benefits and things like that. So people move back with their parents, a lot of people rely on their kind of reduced but still existing pensions that their grandparents would get. You have like, you know, a very strong moving back into a family kind of unit, living together situation. And that has kept the situation afloat. In any other country in Europe, or like Germany, and I'm guessing Sweden, I don't know that much, if you have the kind of breakdown of the welfare system, people are going to die in the streets. Because there's no other, like, I know that for Germany, there's no other, like, safety net beyond that. So one-tenth of the kind of austerity measures that was imposed in Greece, if it was imposed in a country that actually has this, like, mechanisms in place, would have completely different results. And a reaction of people to that would also have different results. They have a different dynamic. But Greece was kind of like caught in a situation where it wasn't really significant in economic sense in relation to the rest of the Eurozone. It only has like 2% of the GDP of the Eurozone. And there was a very clear decision that this is going to go through at whatever cost. I don't think they could make the same choice for other countries. You know, I don't think they could do it without this blowing up in their face.
It's more or less a continuation of my first question, just that the thing you just said as well, I mean, that might be that the attitude of the strongest countries of the European Union and against Greece, and consequences of this, I mean, that they don't talk about it much, it's just so, you know, very hard against, I mean, discussions about leaving or just not paying or the whole thing. And I mean, could be it's maybe you said it before as well, but let's talk about Greece and let's just make it short and say no way and. To show the other countries, you know, that they might be a little bit afraid of, like, losing Italy and this country. I mean, that would be serious, you know. So, okay, Greece is easy. Let's just, you know, put the foot down. And this might have the consequences that people are starting to always, like always, you know, make this, nationalist or at least a nation-based analyses of the whole thing, that, oh, it's Germany and Greece, and this because of maybe because of Italy and the other countries, but let's not talk about them, and like, let's be really hard and make an example of almost like something. But,
yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, I mean, I'm sure they're scared. I'm sure, like, the ones who are responsible for managing this thing are quite scared of what's going to come in the future. But I don't think that they don't really see any alternative. Like, from their own perspective, the discussion is either a continuation of austerity of this form or some form of Keynesianism. And this Keynesianism they have, like, they consider not viable anymore. And to a certain extent, from their perspective, they are right. You know, it's not really a way to resolve this crisis. Of course, the neoliberal model on the other side is not even, it's like it's also a failure. Maybe they're not ready to admit that yet, but it's also a failure because you can see that it's kind of contributing to the disintegration of the Eurozone. But at the same time, you know, it's so far so good. This is the kind of, like, you know, policy they're following. And to the extent that it works, it's keeping them running. I don't think they have a long-term understanding of the crisis. I think they have a very short-term understanding of management of a crisis, and not long-term. I don't think they see that far ahead. And if you look at some of the things they do, they're completely stupid or insane sometimes.
Yeah, if you look at like what politicians say and what they say in the media, but if you look at what like the strongest like business leaders say, that's something else. I think they're more they're much more like ahead, or like looking at alternatives and like reading David Graeber books or something. It's like, oh, it might be okay, capitalism might not work in the future, and starting to think about it. But I mean, the politicians won't talk about that, but that might cause chaos. So, but if you look at what they say, and like more inofficial business, I mean, top of the top, you know, I think that might be something else, but very hard to discuss because it's, you know, it's not.
I mean, in relation to, like, you know, radical scene, I would say, yeah, quite often they're further ahead than us. We have, like, a kind of an ability to, you know, capitalize on our histories and stuff. We always start fresh, whereas they have a kind of continuation, historical continuation that they're really aware of. At the same time, I don't think that it is true that they have a long-term plan. Politics in itself is just a spectacular side of the situation, but at the same time, the political class or governments or like institutions like that, I think they are in charge with a kind of mediation between competing capitalist interests. And like, you could have like the head of industrialists, you know, talking about a certain direction, but that could be devastating in the long run for other sectors of the economy. And the political class is in this position of trying to mediate these different like antagonistic sometimes units in order to have a kind of more generalized long-term thing. That's officially or theoretically the case. I don't think they're kind of in a position to do that. And I think that has to do with a very general decay of capitalist production, which is like a much bigger debate and discussion. But it has to do with the kind of like constant drop of productivity globally in the last 40 years. And in a way, it shows that they're not in a position to actually foresee that far ahead in the future. But that's kind of like really whole different discussion. I don't want to really get into that, unless, you know, it's interesting. But
it interests Albin.
Yeah, I can see.
Yeah, because I think that it's not about Greece; it's about the world economy. Basically, they're afraid of a domino effect of defaults. Yeah. Of nation states and banks and the return of the situation in 2008, basically.
Yeah.
So that's why they can't just be reckless. They have to pump in all the money that they can, even if there's no perspective of them Greece repaying the debt.
Yeah.
They just have to postpone the inevitable, so to speak.
Yeah. And I mean, looking at it a bit from a distance, you can see it's not even a kind of what is seen as a contrast between neoliberal strategy and the Keynesian one is not really realistic, because both these forms are used and have been used in the crisis in the last 5 years. I mean, in some way or another, that the US has dealt with the crisis by, you know, printing money, basically. That's Keynesian, that's not neoliberal. That's not allowing like capital to destroy itself. And the same thing happened in Germany. In Germany in 2008 and 9, they did a very strong Keynesian program of protecting jobs, making sure that investments were kept high, of you know, subsidizing, you know, certain companies in order to avoid defaults and stuff like that. So in one part of the economy, they did a very strong Keynesian kind of program. So it's not so much that they're like, you know, neoliberal dogmatic idiots and stuff. They would use all possible means to manage the situation. But I would still insist that this is all short term. You know, it's not really providing a new... What would change the situation would be a new relationship between labor and capital that becomes more productive. And this they haven't found yet. They're just dealing with the problems as they appear, but they haven't found a way of relating those two in such a way that's...
I wanted to go back to the question about the possibilities of change within the national context, like, because you brought up the failure of the movement in this period, 2010-12, and then you said that it was it became politicized in the sense that, okay, then it became a question of identifying themselves to like a specific party and political platform and going to the political institutions, so to speak. I just wanted to know more about how do you see this relationship between the political institutions and the civil society or the workers' movement. Because the way I see what is happening now in Spain is quite a different thing. It's sort of the opposite. At least up until now, there seems to be quite a harmony between very grassroots democratic activity and change and debate and what is being constituted now as the within the political institutions, and not just with Podemos, with the recent elections, in the most municipal elections you had this they created political platforms, crowdsourced their platforms and so on and so forth. So it looks very good up until now, you know, the potential for a change in society, and also using the political institution as a tool, and also reforming the political institutions. And okay, Greece is not in the same path. It has maybe lost this opportunity for the last years. I don't know. Just a deduction from what you said. But I'm also thinking, like, okay, now that Syriza is in power, they have some leverage to start some reforms, at least. Even reforms that the Troika is pushing them to do, like to tackle corruption and so on. They could, you know, it could be part of a broader package in order to deepen the democratic process. And like, I'm just talking in terms of potential, not at maybe what's actually happening, because I'm not really following what Syriza is doing internally, you know.
Well, they're not doing anything. Let's put it that way. They haven't done anything so far. They're still in the negotiation process. So basically, you know, it has become clear that the Troika says you're not allowed to take unilateral decisions on any kind of level. And they've kept to that so far, to the extent that they're still waiting for an agreement. So they haven't done anything that they could have done, because the idea is you're not, you know, Troika doesn't allow any kind of measures to be taken that could have an impact on the fiscal policy of Greece. That doesn't mean anything, you know. Anything could have an impact on this fiscal policy, you know, it's like it's not clear. There are a lot of things that don't have an impact, but Troika would say that they do. It's, so basically they haven't done anything so far, let's put it that way. Now, I'm not sure what you mean deepening the democratic process. I'm not sure what that term refers to. But like, I'll tell you this, Spain is quite different in terms of Greece. It has both in a positive sense. I think there are like development there of movements which you don't have in Greece, like for example this Plataforma against the evictions,
yeah.
Which is massive, extremely effective and very, very interesting. And it's a result of the stupidity of the Spanish ruling class to go forward with like these evictions, like 500,000 evictions since 2007. That's insane. You know, you're just forcing people to live on the street and that can't go well. So this has created, like, objectively, a kind of situation where they have very interesting things in Spain. At the same time, I think from the beginning in Spain, you had a very politicized situation as opposed to what I would call a social movement. You know, the biggest demonstrations in Spain in recent years were for the independence of Catalonia, not against austerity. You know, that kind of like says something about the situation there. And there haven't been such high dynamic kind of movements in Spain as much in contrast or apart from the Plataforma thing, I would say, because the level of austerity is not as harsh as in Greece, with the exception of this eviction, which I find like hard to understand why the Spanish, you know, decided to do that. But with the exception of that, the austerity is not as harsh as you have in Greece, and I think that means that the movement is also not at that kind of radical, is not forced to be radicalized, you know, in the same way. But yeah, I think you have to come back to this democratic process and the deepening.
Yeah,
because I don't
wanted
understand.
To know what your take was in this in relation to the official political institutions and the possibility of change. Through the political or outside completely the political institutions. Because I see a more, at least more harmonious connection so far in the case of Spain, in terms of, you know, grassroots movement and what they're proposing to come, so to speak, to power and what to do from the political institutions, you know, as people who got elected and changed completely. And
well, if it's more harmonious in Spain, it's because they haven't been elected yet. I mean, once they get elected, then you have to like actually measure the harmony between what a movement is demanding and what is actually happening. I don't think they have the possibility to do anything. I'm not so much into this like dogmatic, like I don't care about institutions and stuff idea, but I would say, like on a very common sense level, you know, historically it has been proven it doesn't really work like that. I mean, official institutions are concerned with like national politics, which means the national economy. National economy already presupposes that you accept a kind of concept of growth and of kind of job creation and a kind of, you know, stability. These are not, you know, this cannot be reconciled with what I would consider like proletarian needs. You know, the stability of an economy means that the banks have to be, you know, solvent, for example. Okay, that means that people have to lose their houses. You know, that means, you know, that situation, which on the one hand forces people outside of their houses, and at the same time ensures like the stability of banks, is what is considered a stable economy. National politics, parliamentary parties are concerned with that kind of national economy. And for me, it's like, in a very simple way, or simplistic if you want, this is like not reconcilable with proletarian needs.
I mean, as you've shown, it's not reconcilable with their own programs of the parties. Even serious as kids.
Yeah, to a certain extent.
I think that's what's so striking is the fantasy of return to a certain kind of growth, and I mean, you see, just the, like, the whole identity of, you know, Western countries, which are the ones I know, are just so predicated on the post-war boom. You know, Sweden, for example, both the left party and the, you know, the far-right party, I mean, I can't speak to the specifics of their platforms, but their whole ethos is one of return to before the crisis. Mm. And a certain kind of, welfare state, obviously different models of cultural identity, but nevertheless, it's still a fantasy of return to the post-war boom. But it seems like without that fantasy, that social movements are at a loss as well. Or is it the case that social movements that acknowledge the crisis as such and kind of live in its contradiction? That's the kind of question I had in my head. Are the social movements that we're talking about, for example, that happened on the ground in Greece, were they predicated on a vision of Greece as it was? Or was there at any point the possibility for something else, something beyond just the return to the state of affairs as it existed? Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. But I think the answer is, like, it really depends from your specific standpoint, how do you explain this? And what I mean is that if you're like a neoliberal in Greece, you would say, oh, all these people fighting, they just want to retain their, like, clientelist relationships to the state, for example. You know, that would be the neoliberal critique of the movement. Like, they just want to retain the situation as it was, which was, like, already not working, blah, blah, blah. If you're, like, more radical, you would say people are fighting against the devaluation of their lives. What these people were doing was exactly the same thing, but there are different ways of expressing it, you know. So depending on your standpoint, you could say, like, many different things about this movement.
Those were both conservative. I mean, insofar as devaluation meant return to national growth, a la kind of post-war boom.
Yeah, or it could be seen from a radical perspective, like, you know, refusing to accept the fact that you have to pay for this crisis. You know, in that sense, like a refusal of devaluation, like the fact that you have to accept like wage cuts or like benefit cuts or a number of like a destruction of health system, blah blah blah, in order for, you know, the banks to remain afloat, you know. And right, practically what you do might be the same thing, but like depending on how you look at it, you have like a different kind of response. I would say both things were present.
There's still people fighting to reproduce their situation as clients of the state, a la, you know, what neoliberals would say. There's not a vision of how to have social existence, how to, you know, not die from cancer without that. There's no kind of like vision of a society beyond the, you know, the managerialism of the welfare state.
Yeah, I mean, yes, but I would say, okay, how do visions like that get created? I would say in a process of struggle. So like in a certain sense, people in Greece were forced to start like as, you know, certain activities and like practical ways of dealing with the crisis that led them towards like radical paths that they wouldn't have imagined or never considered as part of a general vision, you know, but they were kind of forced to do. And I would say the same thing goes for Spain. In this case of the evictions movement, you know, people are kind of the expression or the official language of this movement might be that, you know, banks should be fair and not be so, you know, parasitic, blah blah blah. But in reality, what they're doing is they're saying our needs, you know, are beyond banks, and we don't give a fuck about all these banks. You know,
except that when the horizon of the movement in the case of Greece was to protect it from the crisis, I mean, it seems like after the fact that's the conclusion to be drawn. Greece wasn't able to protect itself from austerity. And that was the end of the movement, because there was no other horizon. And I guess, you know, the extrapolation then would be, you know, the lack of visible social movements, you know, here and lots of other places, where this is the case, where it's the attempt to hold on to the, you know, benefits of the welfare state and where politics are constituted, you know, there.
I agree with the idea that there's always like a certain horizon in struggles, but what I don't agree with is that you can know this in advance. Every time you start a struggle, its horizon starts anew, you know. So this is always like the kind of dynamic. It's not something you can say before, that, you know, if a movement starts now, it can only go as far. We can only say that for Greece in retrospect, you know, after we've seen the result. But you couldn't have said that before, I think. And the same thing would go for other like situations where things are not, you know, in a similar way as they went in Greece.
And you mentioned during your talk that you were hesitant to sort of talk about the future movements in Greece, but now we're kind of we're almost getting into that. So the change, is there a change dynamic? Are the dynamics changed, or the possibilities for struggle, have they changed? Even if this leftism of the government is only a pose or fake or whatever. For example, if you buy into the explanation of the failure of the last wave of resistance as a result of repression, does the new government's supposed or whatever leftism sort of protect this wave of movement or maybe the next wave of resistance from repression in some way? I mean, do they kind of have to be nicer because they are left? Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah.
Is there an opportunity there?
I mean, it's kind of funny. They're trying to be nicer, but the anarchists don't let them. You know, it's kind of, they're pushing them, you know, to show their repressive, you know, face so much that, you know, they're kind of, in the end, they're kind of forced to. Syriza is like, it's the left-wing party, but it's a state mechanism. You know, state mechanism cannot tolerate certain things no matter what its politics are. And I think that's just like a common rule. I just heard in the last couple of days I was here about the way the Swedish police treats squats or demos and stuff in the last few years, and it's like pretty amazing the intensity and violence they use for a social democratic paradise like Sweden. You know, it's kind of contradictory, but I would say it just proves the point. If you have a state mechanism, certain things cannot be tolerated, and Syriza would be very glad to use all these mechanisms in order to deal with any threat. When that threat appears, because at the moment there is no threat.
Yeah.
No.
Because there was, I remember when they were elected, there was some talk that there was it could be considered a breathing room or whatever.
Yeah.
Some sort of radical movement.
Maybe
time to collect their breath, whatever. But there hasn't been any signs of that.
Well, I mean, my personal opinion, I think, would be, no, that there haven't been signs. I'm sure a lot of people in Greece would disagree with me on that, but no, I don't think there has been. The idea of a breathing space was partly based on the fact that Syriza was going to like do a number of things that were like beneficial. They talked about, for example, abolishing the specific like police unit that has been very effective in like repressing. There was this general idea, okay, it's a left-wing government, so there might be more, you know. They haven't really done any of that. They didn't even abolish this unit, although it really would have been very easy and costless for them to do it, and a good sign that, you know, they're kind of moving in the right direction. They didn't even do that. The anarchy scene at the same time, the radical scene in Greece, I think, is a bit at a loss at the moment, because they don't have a focused point. They're very much into this, like, I would say, dead-end kind of Antifa activities, you know, at the moment when neo-Nazis are no longer around, really. Most of them are in prison. But still, this kind of thing is still quite strong in Greece, the Antifa thing. You don't have a lot of social issues, you know. It's more political. They had like this hunger strike of political prisoners, and they had like, you know, Antifa activities. But this is where they're basically moving, and I don't know what the future is going to bring at all, because once Syriza signs the new memorandum agreement, and while later it becomes clear that, you know, the situation is not only not going to change, but it's probably going to get worse, you know, anything could happen. But I would say that if we can get, have any kind of useful lesson from the experience of the past years, is that nothing could really take place in Greece on its own unless you have a change of dynamics in other countries. And for that, I cannot speak very clearly. You know, I don't know what could happen in other places. If it happens in other places, then things could change as well in Greece. But to the extent that it remains isolated, I think it's been proven that it has no room to maneuver. In a certain way, and I don't want to exaggerate that, but I would say the failure of the movement is kind of related to Syriza's failure. I mean, in general, there is not much room to move in this situation if you're not, you know, in a position to push really hard. And you can't push really hard if you're, like, isolated.
What do you think about the need for spreading the experience from the struggles between 2010 and 2012 to other countries, like spreading experience, more active? Could that be a point? Or?
I think it's a great idea, but I don't really know how that works. Because, like, it's not just like a set of ideas that people like put into practice. People were forced by objective conditions to develop like certain ways of resisting, and if you don't have similar conditions in other places, you couldn't really copy, you know, the kind of forms of
course.
But I'm not saying you mean that, but I'm just trying to think, what would that spread of experience mean, especially in a movement that was kind of defeated. You know, it's also
but it could be inspiring in some ways, because most people, I think, just the media's picture of Greece, for example, is very, very hard propaganda. Like, this country can't take care of itself, and spreading that picture like hides those experiences from larger amounts of people. That could be inspiring. Like, you see, in an earlier situation in history where the people who have been radicalized could have been radicalized by the idea of something happening in France, not like taking the actual way they do it, but just the idea that there are people revolting. And
I mean,
like, you talked about how leading capitalists had a way of planning and seeing, learning from history, but how could we actually actively?
I mean, personally, I think I might be wrong. I hope I'm wrong, but I think I'm not. I think people get interested in the experiences of other struggles when they find themselves in struggle and trying to figure out ways of dealing with problems. Unless that happens, it's just kind of an abstract, you know, understanding. So I think when people, like today, like I see in Germany, most people have this idea of Greece, oh, these lazy Greeks who are doing bullshit, blah, blah, blah. The reason they have this filtered, you know, through the media and stuff, is because in fact they don't actually care what's going on in Greece. You know, it doesn't really affect them. If it starts affecting them in ways, then you will have a kind of different interest. Not necessarily positive, but you have a kind of different engagement. And furthermore, if people in Germany start struggling about something, then I would think a lot of them would try to find examples of how these things worked. And then they would start looking at Greece in a different way. Right now, at the moment where there is no struggle and people are not really immediately affected by what's going on, I don't really feel it's like, I don't know, for me at least, it doesn't sound like a very effective thing to do, to kind of, at the same time I'm here speaking about it, so, but like, we're just like, you know, a few people.
It's completely related to this question. I mean, there is networking, always, so, When it was more lively on the ground in Greece, maybe you can tell us how much of networking has been done, you know, with other countries and other experiences. Or right? I think that's the point of entry into connecting with other experiences and creating other horizons and learning from other experiences and so on. It's really, that's something good that the globalization has brought to the social movements, you know, this interconnectedness, either by internet or person, you know, because it's much more easy. It's much easier to travel and to communicate nowadays and to do this networking. Yeah. So I don't know, how does it look like international networking in Greece?
Okay, I really feel that I'm really pessimistic in all my answers. There's a lot of information around. Okay, in terms of internet, it's easier to connect, it's easier to, you know, if people want to find out about something, it's much easier to do it today than it was in the past. I'm not sure how much that actually changes things, you know. Information is available, but information is quite different from my actual experience, or not, I don't mean immediate experience, but I mean a kind of immediate relation to something. Everybody was looking at Greece for the last, you know, for the previous years, especially when the struggles were at a very high point. And certain things, of course, jumped over to other places. You have like certain, you know, experiences that were visible in a kind of very general way, passed around to other places. Like when Gezi Park happened in Turkey, you could see a lot of people there who had not been involved in something like that before, using the experience they saw from like the Greek riots immediately, like from the first day. People who had no experience of riots kind of had a way of like, you know, dealing with that. But it wasn't just because they were looking at Greece. I mean, that was one way. The other one was that they were actually involved in a struggle and were forced to find answers for what was happening to them, you know. And I think that's the key point, rather than the kind of spread of information, because that we do have. I think it's the easiest thing in the world to just go around and find out, okay, unless we're talking about countries where language is a complete barrier. But even in terms of like, you know, Egypt, Tunisia, you know, we have like lots of comrades there that we met in this final like few years, and we have a constant contact. But apart from information, it doesn't really, you know, lead to anywhere else. That's what I think. But as I said, I'm not very optimistic about things lately, but
no, but it is a satisfactory answer. I agree also with you that people seek out the information and the experience of the others when they are in need of it. Mm. When they're actually experiencing something and they do not know how to handle, so they go after the information and contact people and so on and so forth. But you talked about the Arab Spring, so that's one interesting thing.
Yeah. And another disaster.
But I think that, like, the experience about how things happen, like the social process, like how you organize a strike or a neighborhood committee or whatever, that might be very useful, like to see the lapse from it being nothing or very little to becoming greater.
Yeah.
And that can be used in organizing and struggles right now, here and now. I worked at the Post for many years, and when we built struggles about small things like the speed of work or the amount of mail we had to sort, we used all sorts of examples from similar or very dissimilar struggles. That sort of made us see what we could do, not that we exactly did, what they did in France in the 1930s, but we were sort of inspired by how they did it, like how and why, not just that it happened. If someone would have said, yeah, there was this huge sabotage movement at the railway in France in the 30s, that would have made nothing. But when you talk about, like, yeah, they talk, they changed the, how they organized using the trains, and communicated by the trains and shifted the direction of the trains in opposite to the way they were supposed to be directed. That will make sense for in a postal worker perspective here and now.
Of course,
so I believe there are a lot of things to be learned from the experience of struggles.
For sure. But in a way, that's my point. It's, if I understood right, when you were in a process of struggle, you were forced to look at like ways that have been, you know, and I think that's the only way. I'm only questioning, if you want, the idea that it is our role as, I don't know, radical people to take over this information spreading as the key political work that we should be doing. That's kind of what I'm not really comfortable with. But I would never say that it's not useful, of course. It's like extremely useful, yeah.
And in those struggles, for example, that the postal office really took quite active roles in spreading information.
Can you speak up, Leo?
We took some, I would say that we took some active role in like spreading information on our specific workplaces. So I think in the small sense around your community, I think you should take an active role in some cases, not like taking over the role of spreading all the information and becoming the party or something, but sometimes when you have to reach out a hand for the postal office next door alone in the other part of the city, and I think we have roles there, not like sitting and waiting for struggles to appear. And We have to take part in everyday life around us, and the struggles have to start there, but we also have to reach out hands and spread the experience. And like the community, the state and the other apparatus is always spreading their picture, and like around your community you could take part in spreading another picture.
Yeah, I don't think we really disagree. I'm just maybe, I'm just saying it becomes more effective when there is an actual struggle going on.
Yeah.
That's all. But like, what were you describing? I've done the same thing when I was working in similar kind of environments. Mm. That's what you do, and it's great, you know. But in the absence of like actual like big movements, it becomes a bit.
Last year, and there's going to be another one this year, there's a conference in Malmö called Connecting European Struggles, which is has speakers from Greece and last year Ukraine and Finland and stuff like that. And there is a weird sense of just what you said, like in the absence of a real struggle, we sort of used that kind of, and I'm talking very much in the Swedish context there, we used that kind of gatherings mostly as a means to uphold the social sphere more than anything. Like, you meet your friends, you meet people from other countries, you drink coffee, you talk, you have a nice time, and then you have done your communism for the day or whatever. So I think I understand what... I understand your critique, and I agree. Even though I have spent quite a lot of time on different congresses, getting people from different countries to drink coffee, but I think we're talking about a little bit about different things, because at those sort of congresses, you have 50 people at the most, like, and they are all people that you know, and they are all radicals. It's not like you walk out onto the street with pamphlets and come see this Finnish guy talk about anti-fascism in the 80s in his little town, because nobody cares. It's got a completely different reasons for doing that than, for example, how you act when you're in a struggle at your workplace when you want to win a battle, for example. Different things, and I mean, in some sense you have to uphold this sort of social aspect of movement or whatever, But you shouldn't be fooled into thinking that it is struggle.
Yeah. In that sense.
There was no question there. Just
that's fine. You can stop this kind of question-answer kind of format because it's like.
If it's time to round up, or there are any further questions or issues? We still have some time if we want to continue the discussion.
Maybe we can continue at the restaurant at Hagabee and eat.
What?
Yeah. I said maybe we continue over some food.
Yeah. I had some food just before.
Good.
Yeah, let's continue, but we can make it less formal, you know. Yeah. Kind of.
The center,
sitting here, kind of like, you know, I'll tell you what it's all about. You know, I don't know. And I want to smoke a cigarette. Yes. Yeah.
So we'll do that.
How much did we record? Like 2 hours?
2 hours.